Let's open our Bibles to the first page, page number one. Now, I know some of you are going to want to come up to me after the Bible study and show me the concordance or the table of contents or your family tree or all those other pages that'll be in front of it. But I only get to do that, use that line about once every 12 to 15 years. So as we're starting Genesis now, bear with me. If you will, as we turn to page one, the book of beginnings. And it addresses many questions. I mean, the book is just more than just simply a book of beginnings. It's a book of salvation. There is so much of what God's plan for his people is revealed and unveiled through this book. And as I said in my opening prayer, I'm kind of excited about this time that we're going to have. Most of the Hebrew names of their books of the Old Testament, you know, they have the same Bible that we do in the Old Testament, and they're arranged a little differently, and they have, of course, their own names for them. And most of them are just simply the first letters, the first clause or the phrase of whatever the book would be. In the case of Genesis, it's the word Bereshit, which is the Hebrew word that means in the beginning. And our name, Genesis, comes from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, and it's Genesis. And our word Genesis comes from that, which means origins, creation, or beginning as well. And it starts off in verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. There are three in the beginnings in the Bible. There are three beginnings. There's the first one that we have here in Genesis 1:1, where it says, in the beginning, God. And this is the beginning of creation. The second one we see is in John 1:1, where it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word, he goes on to say, is God. And this is the beginning of the incarnation. It's just talking about there's several beginnings, and this is a different beginning. This was the beginning of Jesus Christ's incarnation as he came into the world. And in the third place is in 1 John chapter 1, verse 1, where it says, what was from the beginning? And he goes on to say that we've held and we've touched and handled, that we've seen with our eyes and so on and so forth. And this is the beginning of eternity, if you will. In other words, you say, well, how did eternity have a beginning? Well, it didn't, but it's what he's saying is, when all other things began, Jesus was. And so that's what 1 John chapter 1, verse 1 is talking about. Now, the key word of Genesis chapter 1 is the word make, or create, or to fashion, or to form. And there are two Hebrew words that we'll be looking at tonight, or that are taken into our text in Genesis chapter 1. The first one is the word bara, which in the beginning God created. It's the word created, and he uses it several other times throughout the chapter. And the easiest way to understanding bara is to just say that it means to create out of nothing. Every time it occurs in the Bible, it occurs many times throughout the Old Testament, but every time, without exception, whenever the word bara is used, it's always has God as the subject. It's always something about God did, because what the word literally means is to create out of nothing. In the old Latin translation of the Old Testament, in the Vulgate, it's the phrase ex nihilo. Those that may be from Catholic backgrounds, you may be familiar with the Latin term. And it just simply means out of nothing. And that's the Greek or the Hebrew equivalent of that is bara. And the second Hebrew word is the word asah, which means to do or to make. It has more of the idea of what a potter does with the clay, or what a builder does with a bunch of bricks. You know, it's to make something out of what you have. You have your supplies, and then with those supplies you make, or we would use the term create, but you can see it's quite a bit different than creating something out of nothing. And that word is used, actually it's used 11 times in Hebrew, in Genesis 1 and 2. So it also is a very common word. When you're talking about Genesis 1 and the creation story, the issue of creation, there are three aspects of this physical universe, and there is time, space, and matter. And sometimes you'll hear the guy say the time, space, and matter continuum. And I remember hearing that phrase and that word all of my life growing up, and even as an adult, and I had, this boy ain't no idea what the word continuum meant, you know. And if you were to look it up in a dictionary, the word continuum means that it's a continuous series or whole, no part of which is perceptibly different from the adjacent parts. Let me explain that a little bit. I think what this is saying is that God didn't create the universe in some sort of a daisy chain. You know, some sort of like, first there was some time. Like, he started off and he said, well, let's make some time. And so he made time. And then he said, okay, let's put something in the time. So he made space. And then after he did that, he said, okay, now I got all this space but nothing in it. Let's make some stuff and we'll put it in the space. Now that we got the time, we got the space, then let's put some stuff in the space. But in a time, space, matter continuum, it's not like time, then space, then matter. It's time, space, and matter. They're all the same. They happen simultaneously. They happen in complete conjunction with one another. And there'll be more about this later. Now, today, if you were to listen to the average college professor or the average astrophysicist or geologist or talking head on the nightly news, they would speak as though any idea of what I'm going to be saying over the next few minutes is completely elementary, completely unintellectual, and completely outdated, outmoded, century-old mindset. And I would just, you know, I say, you know, bless their hearts, but that's not true. And if you go to, I was doing some research on it this morning, and I stumbled across this website, rationalwiki.org. And they don't have a list of all of the creationist scientists, PhD. They have lists of the creation scientists, PhDs. In fact, there were so many, there's so many hundreds of them, they had to list them by A, B, C, D, and so forth. So if you want to just see how many people are of a PhD level or above that believe in part or in whole what I'm going to be teaching tonight, I would encourage you to go to that website and check it out. You know, as I've said many times before, I am not a scientist. I only play one in the pulpit. And I, you know, I'll be throwing out a few things that I have run across in my research, and most of it is just, you know, I would fully agree that I'm not a scientist. I would fully state that there are people of the secular evolutionary construct who could talk me down in a heartbeat. I'm not a scientist, but I know guys who are. And I know guys that have studied this out very much, and it is not only a tenable position, but I think it is the most rational one. What I'm going to be sharing in the time that we have tonight, there are a lot of detractors, some of them even within the church. Not all. This is not some sort of a monolithic view that I'm going to be sharing that all Christians will march to the same beat. Even within the church, of course, obviously outside of the church, but within the body of Christ, there are some that would take issue. And the critics, oftentimes, the secular evolutionists, for example, they'll come back with a response, and they'll say, well, you can't trust the data that come out from the creation scientists because they have a bias. You know, they are entering into it with a bias. Well, probably. But if you think that you can trust the data that's been given to us by the secular evolutionist and you can think that their data is not biased, I've got some vials of miracle water that I'd like to sell you, you know? I mean, there's going to be, and, you know, it's kind of like in the book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, they say, you know, they say bias as though that's a problem. Everybody has a bias. That shouldn't reflect upon the data. You know, I mean, if the data says a certain thing, it doesn't not say it just because you might have a bias toward it. So the bias involved in that shouldn't have any effect. And most of the evidence that we're going to be looking at, I'm going to try not to overwhelm you with a lot of stuff because I don't have a lot of stuff to overwhelm you with. It's not going to be the sort of thing that what I'm going to be sharing is going to be, oh boy, I can't wait the next time I see a college prof and I unload this on him. Because these things I'm going to be sharing tonight are not a surprise to those that are on the humanistic, evolutionary, secular side of the theory of things. You know, they're not going to go, oh gosh, I never thought of that before. And they are familiar with these positions and they will have their answers. And so, you know, you're probably not going to use anything that I'm going to present to you tonight that would end the debate because it's been going on for a long time. But you can know that while they may have answers, the things that they say are not a surprise to the creation scientists who know what their arguments and their responses are going to be, and they've got responses to their responses. And so when the discussion is elevated to that level, there is a pretty strong position that we hold as Christians. The Bible is not a science book, okay? It never purports to be. There's never any of its various 30-some, maybe 40 authors that have ever claimed to be. It's not a science textbook. But the purpose of the Bible is not, somebody said this a long time ago, and it got a good meter and it's easy to dance to, the purpose of the Bible is not to tell us how the heavens go. The purpose of the Bible is to tell us how to go to heaven. And that's the primary focus. So it's not given to us in a, you know, for example, God never does try to prove his existence. You know, God wrote a book and the purpose of the book was not to prove his existence. And, you know, if you were to sit down and write a book, you probably wouldn't have to tell anybody that wouldn't have to start off by proving that you exist. You write a book that kind of shows that you exist. So that was kind of God's position when he started off in the beginning. So just because the Bible doesn't defend God's existence in that regard doesn't mean that it's not there. And while it's not a science textbook, where it does touch on science, I believe it is always 100% correct. Now, there have been sometimes down through the ages some problems with interpretation, but the Bible has always been correct whenever it touches on science. And another thing I would say is that I don't believe the Bible accommodates, it doesn't condescend to the superstitions and the ignorance of the people of the day that of the Bible's writing. You know, for example, when the Gospels talk about people being demon-possessed, this is not just simply because they didn't understand schizophrenia in the first century. No, when the Bible says somebody was demon-possessed, they were possessed by a demon. And I think the Bible makes a very clear distinction between that and mental illness. So while sometimes it's hard to tell the difference as we're looking at somebody, whether it's demonic or mental breakdown, the Bible doesn't accommodate the ignorance or the superstitions of the culture. There is what's known as, and maybe you've heard this phrase before, and this is a good one to remember because it makes you sound so smart, but there is what's called the fortitudinous concurrences of accidental circumstances. And this is the secular evolutionary scientist way of explaining origins. They say, well, the way everything came into being is that there was this fortitudinous concurrence of accidental circumstances. In other words, that's a very high-sounding way of saying that life spontaneously generated. That there was not life, but then there was this stuff, there were these proteins, and there were these gases, and there was this heat, and there was this pressure, and there was a longer ago than Star Wars, you know, long ago, a long bit of time, and then one day there was a fortitudinous concurrence of accidental circumstances that made these proteins become life. Sir Frederick Hoyle, not the guy that teaches us how to play bridge in Texas Hold'em, that was Edmund Hoyle, but Sir Francis Hoyle lived in the 20th century, and he believed that he calculated all this out. He was an astrophysicist in the middle part of the 20th century, and he said the odds of spontaneous generation, the idea that life came from non-life, and that it happened, it was just a fortitudinous concurrence of accidental circumstances, he said it was 1 in 10 to the 120th power. That means, you know, if something has a chance of 1 in 10, it has a 1 in 10 chance. You do it 10 times, it'll happen one time. If it's 1 in 10 to the 20th power, that means that's 1 in 10 with 120 zeros after it. That's a bunch of zeros. That's a big number. I don't know the number. It's 1 in 10 to the 120th power. That's what the number is. And he decided that's what the odds of spontaneous generation are. There was another guy that came after, and actually he's the one that coined the phrase Big Bang, even though he didn't accept it. He didn't believe it to be a viable answer. He did coin the phrase in a radio interview back in the middle part of the 20th century. There was another guy that came after him, Harold Morowitz, and he was professor at George Mason University, contributor to NASA, very smart guy. And even though he factored out, he took Hoyle's figures and reran them, and he came up with a number of 1 in 10 to 100 to 100th billionth power. I can't even say that that way, much less say it the way the name of the number really is. And yet he still vigorously argued against any kind of scientific creationism, any kind of intelligent design, even though he, and do you have any idea how big 1 in 10 to the 100th billion is? I mean, that is so far past infinity that it's just, it's, you know, we just see it as a great big number that we don't understand. It's an unfathomable number. No brain can comprehend that number. And this was the odds of being able to turn some 27 functioning different items into having the right circumstances to be able to create one living bacterium that would come onto the scale. But then in addition to that, you would have to have a, not only do you need a Mr. Bacterium to come because of the fortuitous concurrence of accidental circumstances, you'd have to have a Ms. Bacterium to come along at the same time. She would have to undergo the very same fortuitous concurrences of accidental circumstances, and they would have to meet in the same sludge pond at the same time, and they would have to be able to make little baby bacteriums before Mr. Bacterium died. And then if he died, we'd have to start that process all over again. Died before he ever got to pitch woo. You know, Scrat, the guy from the saber-toothed squirrel guy or whatever he was from Ice Age, he would get the acorn before we'd have a couple of bacteriums get together under those circumstances. You know, it's just beyond any kind of reasonable thinking. Back before Darwin, you know, Darwin didn't really invent this idea that we were products of evolution. He popularized it, he categorized it, he made it mainstream, he developed it a lot, but the idea had been around for several decades, even a century or two, and it was about 30 or 40 years before him. There was a pastor from Pennsylvania named William Paley, who published this little treatise known as The Natural Theology or Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity Collected from the Appearances of Nature. You know, back in 1802 when this was published, the titles were always longer than the books were. And this one was no exception to that. And he gave the, this is what's known as Paley's watchmaker illustration. And he gave the illustration that if I were walking along in the meadow one day and my toe actually kicked against a rock, and I reached down and picked it up, and you were to say to me, how long has that rock been there? And I could say, I haven't got the slightest idea. It could have been here forever, for all of I know. And no one would think anything about it. But then he said, if the next day I was walking through the same meadow and my toe kicked against another object and I reached down and picked it up, and it was a pocket watch, you know, this was 1802 before Timexes. He says, and it was a pocket watch, and someone were to ask me how long had the pocket watch been there, and I were to give the same answer that I gave with the stone, he said everybody would think that would be a ludicrous concept. How could you say that that pocket watch had been there forever? And this argument of Paley's has withstood the time for going on 2.5 centuries now. You know, there have been guys that have made attempts, think they have given adequate arguments against it, but I think it still does bear the credence of investigation. Just for example, the moon's orbit increases at a very immeasurable rate. Did you know that the moon is getting further and further away from the Earth? In fact, the orbit increases at a very sustained rate of about an inch and three quarters, just shy, which is kind of sly without the L. It's just shy of 4 centimeters, and it increases, its orbit increases in 4 centimeters every year. That means that 85 million years ago, the Earth was only about 35 feet above the Earth, which explains the disappearance of the dinosaurs. The taller ones, anyway. That would definitely explain how that happened. You know, there are just any number of different things in science that you take this to your local astrophysicist and they would have some answer for it, but then the local creation scientists would have the answer back to that. But I think things like this are very worthy of consideration. You know, racism has existed ever since the people of the Plain of Shinar left and were dispersed throughout the world after God had confused their languages. There's been racism ever since then. But boy, modern racism really got a hyper steroid-induced jump shot with the rise of Darwinianism. The early Darwinians, and not so much Darwin himself, but guys like Thomas Huxley and some of the other early proponents of Darwinianism, believed that the different races were evidence of evolutionary development and that the white Aryans were at the top of that food chain, that they were a higher form of evolved Homo sapiens. Obviously, that wouldn't be very tenable in today's culture, but that is, I think, a lot of the racism that we see in the world today is still being affected by what happened 150 years ago. You know, here's the thing. There is no other way around this, and I understand that even though the term Darwinianism is still used today and people talk about Darwin being the father of evolution and all of that, most evolutionary people today that are of the PhD or higher level don't believe in the theory of evolution that Darwin taught. They've modified it in a lot of ways. Because it just doesn't work. And I believe if Darwin were alive today, there's no way he would accept what he taught then either. But they still use those terms, even though they have modified and tried to adapt this idea of evolution in light of recent findings. But no matter how much you slice it, no matter how well you dice it, no matter how much you try to change the terminology, evolution basically says that you got a dog and you got a rose, and they both got the same grandpa, a rock. This rock. That's really what evolution teaches. That all life came from non-life, and while the rose and the dog may be separated by several many years, they still had their own common origin. And that all living things, from the lowest form of the single cell amoebas to people like me, we all just kind of oozed out of some sort of green primordial slime. And you know, the thing that so many people oftentimes come back with, and I even see this a lot, you know, as I'm watching YouTube videos and stuff like that, people will come back with, oh yeah, well, where did God come from? You know, and it's almost kind of like, oh God, I never thought of that. You know, I mean, they even say, you know, I was in one video, we're going to show a little clip of it before, and the guy that was debating Dr. Hovind said, you know, how many angels could dance on the head of a pin? And as though that was just some very witty, lofty question that nobody had ever thought of before. And, you know, here's the thing. Either God is eternal or stuff is eternal. Either God made stuff out of nothing or nothing made stuff out of something. Which takes more faith? Which one is harder to accept? And I don't think there's any other way around it. Either we came from slime or we came from God, and it's our choice to decide which one it is. But as I often say, I have the spiritual gift of complication. Oh, Hank, we'll need some audio on this. You got it? Okay. So let's watch this little short video clip of an expert in the field as he was answering the question of where did God come from and how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. Dr. Kent Hovind.
Go ahead. All right, your question, where did God come from, assumes that you're thinking of the wrong, obviously it displays that you're thinking of the wrong God, because the God of the Bible is not affected by time, space, or matter. If he's affected by time, space, or matter, he's not God. Time, space, and matter is what we call a continuum. All of them have to come into existence at the same instant, because if there were matter but no space, where would you put it? If there were matter and space but no time, when would you put it? You cannot have time, space, or matter independently. They have to come into existence simultaneously. The Bible answers that in 10 words. In the beginning, or time, God created the heaven, or space, and the earth. There's matter. So you have time, space, matter created, a trinity of trinities there. Just, you know, time is past, present, future. Space has length, width, height. Matter has solid, liquid, gas. You have a trinity of trinities created instantaneously, and the God who created them has to be outside of them. If he's limited by time, he's not God. The guy who created this computer is not in the computer. He's not running around in there changing the numbers on the screen, okay? The God who created this universe is outside of the universe. He's above it, beyond it, in it, through it. He's unaffected by it. So for and the concept that a spiritual force cannot have any effect on a material body, well, then I guess you'd have to explain to me things like emotions and love and hatred and envy and jealousy and rationality. I mean, if your brain is just a random collection of chemicals that formed by chance over billions of years, how on earth can you trust your own reasoning processes and the thoughts that you think? Okay? So, your question, where did God come from, is assuming a limited God, and that's your problem. The God that I worship is not limited by time, space, or matter. If I could fit the infinite God in my 3-pound brain, he would not be worth worshiping, that's for certain. So that's the God that I worship. Thank you.
So there, yeah. Trinity of Trinities, I love that. That's what a continuum is, what he just said. Okay, according to Dr. John Morris, Henry Morris's son, he has a doctorate in geological engineering that he got from OU, and a really smart guy. I've heard him speak many times before. And he says, now this isn't me, but this is a person that has a PhD in geology. He says, you know, sometimes when people are trying to defend the ages and ages and ages and the years and years and years and all of the stuff of creation and how it took time and time and time and time, and the earth is billions and billions and billions and all of that sort of thing, and they will point to the geological column. You understand what the geological column is? It's all of those layers of strata. And you say, well, can you think of an example of the geological column? And if you ask that question, a lot of people would immediately go, Grand Canyon. And Dr. Morris says there's only one place in the world that the geological column exists, and that's in a college textbook, because it doesn't exist outside of that. And he has shown that very decisively in some of his studies and experiments and references. For example, very Grand Canyon-like geological strata was formed in the weeks and months that followed Mount St. Helens. And so that's, you can go there and you can study it and you can examine it and you can see. And he says, how do you explain the fact that the same fossil, animal fossils that you have in the very bottom layers of the geological column are also in the top layers of the geological column, and there's no evolution between them, and things like that. So, you know, the Washington Monument is another example. I like this one because it took them a while to build it, because they kept, you know, they had things like the Civil War and they ran out of money and things like that. And so they started it back in the 1850s and they didn't get it finished. It wasn't dedicated until 1924. And then a few decades later in the 60s, they had to go down underneath it to do some cleaning. and they found these 5-foot stalactites that, according to the geologists, would take millions and millions of years to form, and it formed under the Washington Monument in 50 years, less than 50 years. A lot of examples like that. In fact, he showed that example. There was one of the caverns, I think it's Carlsbad Cavern, and one of those that used to have this plaque on the outside that talked about all the millions of years that the stalactites took to form. He took the findings from the Washington Monument, and the next time he went back to visit the cavern at the same place, he went back to the same place, and they changed the sign. They'd taken that part of the sign out. When I was a kid, I don't know if they still have this or not, but how many of you remember the Weekly Reader? You know, that was an attempt that they gave us back in school to make us think that reading a newspaper was cool. And so every week we had this Weekly Reader. I remember this edition. I was in, 9 years old at the time, so whatever grade that would put me in, fourth or fifth grade, probably first grade as I look back on it, at 9 years old. But we were looking at our Weekly Readers, and this is right after, in JFK's, I think it was the first inaugural address, I guess it was his only inaugural address, but when he said that we were going to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. And so this was in November of 1960 is when this Weekly Reader came out, and the whole issue was dedicated to the what Kennedy had said about, we're going to put a guy on the moon. We're going to beat those Ruskies because they'd already had a guy in space and we didn't do that yet. There were several things. You see, this was their envisionment of what a space suit was going to look like when the first guy walked on the moon. Well, there was an article on the inside on this thing called the Lunar Excursion Module was what it was called in the beginning. They later changed the name to just Landing Module. But it was called the LEM or the LEM. And they say, you see these four feet, pods on the side of it. This is the actual craft that the astronauts took from the mothership to go down and land on the moon. They couldn't, the spaceship that they took off in couldn't land on the moon. So they had to have a landing craft that, just a little something just for that purpose, and they would go down and land on the moon. But they had these on the feet that were going to land and touch down. They had these probe sensors that were extended out to 6 feet long. And the reason for this is because the scientists knew that on any given year, the Earth is bombarded by billions and billions of dust particles and pounds of dust, of cosmic dust. Just the particles that are out in the space that get caught by Earth's gravitational pull, get pulled down to Earth, and 99% of it gets burned up in the atmosphere. Hardly any of it ever falls to the Earth. But figuring that the moon was the same billions and billions of years that the Earth was, just give or take a few billion, that since it didn't have an atmosphere, factoring in the idea of its lesser gravitational pull, they were afraid that some of this dust that is very fine like flour could be several feet thick. And what was going to happen when this lunar landing module landed on the moon and it would just disappear in a big pile of Pillsbury dough, flour. And so they had these sensors on the bottom. And I remember reading about this when I was in school back in 1960. Well, when the actual lunar module landed, they found that the amount of dust on the moon is actually about, varies from a quarter to just under a half an inch thick, which would be right in par for something that was somewhere between 7 and 10,000 years old. Many things like that. And whatever conclusion a person would come to after looking at the evidence, you cannot escape the fact. And I know there will be people that will deal with this data in different ways and so forth, and they'll have answers to this and that. And I get that. I remember the first time I tried to impress a college professor with my vast knowledge after I'd been a Christian for about 2 weeks, and I got my head handed to me. I get that. I understand that. But whoever a person is, you cannot escape the fact that the universe drips with design from beginning to end. And with all of this, no matter how overwhelming any of the evidence can be, Hebrews 11:6 says, without faith it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. It's all got to be by faith. And so I don't believe God because of the evidence. I believe God by faith, and the evidence just kind of backs it up. And the fact is, I don't have enough faith to believe in evolution. So if you're hearing this for the first time, I just encourage you to check it out. By the way, how old is the universe? That's another question that a lot of people will ask. Well, how old is it? Well, on one hand, you got this guy by the name of, he was the Church of Ireland Archbishop James Usher back in the first half of the 17th century. He was quite a scholar, and he added up all the begats of the Bible. You know, went back from some point that we had known, a date that we could fix by secular history, and then counted backwards from so-and-so begat so-and-so and so-and-so begat so-and-so. And he came to the conclusion that the universe was created in 404 B.C. And then he studied it out a little bit more, and he came to the conclusion that it was actually October 22nd in 4004 B.C. And then after he studied a little more in depth, he said it was around 6 p.m. on October 22nd in 4004 B.C. You know, homie did the best he had with what he had at the time. I don't take anything away from him. This is without a Macintosh. I mean, could you imagine the hours this guy spent crunching numbers and stuff? So my hat's off to him. Probably, no, though, that's not the case. I don't believe in some of the, you know, they're on the other end of the spectrum, you got what they call the gap theory. You've probably heard of that before. And this is the idea that in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In Genesis 1:2, and the earth was without form and void. And they say, the gap theory people say, that there is this indeterminate, just vast time period between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. That in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Time. And the earth was without form and void. And they would say that the word was should better be translated became. The earth became form and void, and without form and void. And their argument would be that God wouldn't create something that didn't have a form and was empty. You know, that would be their argument. A couple of problems with it, aside from the fact that I don't think it fits scientifically. A couple of problems with it is that there's no real solid ground to say that the word was in Genesis 1:2 should be translated became. In fact, in all of my research, I've never found a Hebrew scholar, be they Christian or Jewish, I've never found anybody who knows Hebrew who would say that's the case. Never found anybody. And I've also never found anybody before the rise of evolution that taught it. It appears as though the whole gap theory is basically a reaction to evolution that teaches all these billions and billions of years. Oh no, my faith is going out the window. How can I answer this? Oh, there must be a gap between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. I'm not saying that's everybody that believes in the gap theory believes that, but it does seem to me in my research that that was the origin of it. That's kind of what fueled it in the beginning. You know, what blows me as we look at this, I don't know how old the universe is. The evidence to me seems to indicate it's younger than people believe. Maybe a little bit older than what Jimmy Usher thought, but I would think most of the evidence points to 10,000 years or less. But what blows me away is in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 4, it says that God chose me in him before the foundation of the world. So however old this thing is, I was chosen in Jesus Christ before he ever began it. And that's, I can't wrap my brain around that, so why try to do anything more? One final word before we leave verse 1. 1 Corinthians 15:45 says, "And so it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being, and the last Adam became a life-giving spirit." Of course, the first Adam would be Adam. The last Adam, he says here, would be Jesus. The first Adam became living. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. And this will actually fit better with chapter 2 when we get into the creation of man. I'll probably bring it back up then. But I feel good it would be good to mention here too. That if we can trust there was a first Adam, then we can also trust that there was a last Adam. But if we don't believe that the creation account of Adam is literal, that it's just some sort of mythological, metaphorical kind of a thing to point back to when man first came out of the caves, then how can we trust what the Bible says about the last Adam? And say, well, the creation account was metaphorical, but the salvation account is to be literal. Well, not according to the liberals. You know, they would say the same thing about what we say about the salvation account. They would say, well, it's not to be taken literal. Jesus didn't have to rise from the dead. It's just that his spirit rose from the dead. You know, the spirit of Jesus, the spirit of the resurrection is all that matters. Just that we believe in that, and there's life in believing that, but it doesn't matter if it really happened or not. So if we accept the creation account as literal, I think that we have no problem in receiving anything else that the Bible says is true. But if we question or doubt or deny the accuracy of the creation account, we kind of open the door to the enemy to come in and cause us to question and doubt and deny the rest of the world, word. So it says on here, we're going to get through verse 8. So let's go. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. The word hovering here in Hebrew is the word rochef, which means to shake or to flutter. It kind of has the picture of a mother hen as she is. In fact, the word has the idea of rooting. You know, when the mother hen sets over the nest of the eggs, and she's kind of sitting there trying to warm them until they hatch, and sometimes you'll see her, you know, shake her feathers and kind of flutter around a little bit, and it's that kind of an idea. And the Spirit was doing that. He was brooding over the face of the waters. And then God said in verse 3, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light, saw it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And so the evening and the morning were the first day. Now, I can see critics of the Bible seeing that there's a really big oops right here. The Bible writers didn't really think this through, because here they got light being created 4 days, or 3 days. The sun and the moon and all the sources of light didn't create it until the fourth day. So the Bible writers kind of messed up on that. You know, to me, I think, how cool is that? God created the light 3 days before he created the source of the light. I mean, if it's an ex nihilo, if he created it all out of nothing, what's the big deal? You know, God says ain't no problem. He made the light rays from the stars before he made the stars, and that's kind of cool. You know, and that kind of answers, well, if the stars are so many billion light years away, how did the rays get here in 10,000 years? Well, God just created them. And then he created the rays were here before the stars were. It says in Revelation chapter 21, verse 3, or verse 23, God says, did I miss it? There it is. The city had no need, this is talking about the new city, the new Jerusalem. It had no need for the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. So if God's going to do that in New Jerusalem, he could certainly do that before he created the sun. The word day, yom, some people will say, well, it's not a literal 6 days of creation. That's just, it's like talking about, you know, in the day of Abraham, back in Abraham, or when we say back in the day, you know, we used to, back in my day, we walked to school uphill both ways, you know, all that. And it doesn't mean a literal 24-hour period. Well, anytime outside of Genesis 1, when you see and the word yom, like our English word day, can mean that. It can. But it can also mean 24-hour period. Just like our word day can. And like our word day usually does, so does the word yom usually mean a 24-hour period. In fact, anytime you ever see it with the ordinance, the numerical adjective, first day, second day, third day, it's always a 24-hour period. Always. There's never an exception to it. In fact, anytime you see the clause before it where it says the evening and the morning, remember Hebrew day starts in the evening, so they never say morning and evening. They say the evening of and the morning was the first day. And anytime you see that phrase, evening and morning, it's always a 24-hour period. Anytime evening or morning is connected with the word yom, it always means a 24-hour period. And so if you have the evening and the morning was the first day, the evening and the morning was the second day, it's kind of like God's talking to us in kindergarten here. You know, he's making it just as simple as he can because we want to complicate things. And he's saying, what part of 24-hour period do you not understand? You know, it's really hard to think that both of them combined together can mean anything other than a 24-hour period. And Moses, in writing the book of Exodus in chapter 20, verses 10 and 11, he says, but the seventh day, the seventh yom, is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. And in it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your cattle, your stranger that's in the gates. Nobody. On the Sabbath, nobody does any work. For, he says in verse 11, in 6 days, so Moses doesn't say 6 periods, 6 epochs, 6 eras. He says, in 6 days the Lord made the heavens, the earth, and the sea, and all that's in them. And he rested on the seventh day. So Moses tells us, even in another place, that it's to be taken literally. So I just think we ought to take it literally. Exactly what all that means, I don't have enough knowledge. I just take it literally. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. That was always a confusing one to me as a kid, when I'd hear this verse or read it when I was a kid growing up, because I just thought, what in the world is that saying? What's a firmament anyway? And what it means is, the word firmament means something that's stretched out. It's the idea, if you take a ball of metal, a hunk of metal, and then you take a hammer, like copper or something like that, and you start pounding it out until it's spread out real thin. And it would be, in fact, I have a friend who has a PhD in Hebrew. I called him this week to ask him if this was accurate. It would be the same word that could be used for, the NIV in the New American has the word expanse. That's probably a better idea of it. He separated the expanse from the waters above and the waters below. But it would be kind of similar if you took a lump of dough and rolled over it with a rolling pin. That it would be that kind of, that's what the word firmament means. It doesn't mean that, therefore it follows that, you know, there is a flat earth society even today. I don't know if you knew that, but there are some guys around today that say the earth is flat. This is a map of the flat earth that one of their members drew back in the 80s. And they actually believe it. You know, I guess they've never seen a lunar eclipse, or they've never taken an international plane flight, or seen a ship appear over the horizon of the ocean, or anything like that. But you know, they do believe in the flat earth. And the Hebrew word for that is nah. No, that's not so. What the word means is to take something that appears to be small and make it big. It appears to be small and you make it appear to be big. You know, you got this vantage point of something being small, and then you have the vantage point of it being big. That's all it means. I think you could say that I believe in the Big Bang. You know, I believe in the Big Bang. God said it, and bang, there it was. And the only construct in which this has difficulty in comprehending, or at least receiving in some sort of a godless secular box, this is the only construct. You know, there's no other way of thinking of this in any other way, that it just... there was nothing, and God said, let there be something, and bang, there it was. You know, for those who believe in a God who is outside of the box, just as Dr. Hovind was saying in the video clip, it's no big thing. We believe in the God whom the evidence supports to that end. This is really one of the smallest of the faith walk steps for me. You know, when God calls us to walk by faith, there's a lot bigger obstacles, lot bigger steps I have to get over what walking by faith is than believing this. And thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters that were above it, and it was. And God called the firmament heavens. Literally what he's talking about is sky up there. He called the up there part heaven, and he called the down here part earth. And so the evening and the morning were the second day. Let's pray. God, we do thank you. You are creator. We worship you. And I pray, Lord, that just the facts of the story of what you did so that you could have us in fellowship and relation with you, God, I pray that those wouldn't be obscured by people that try to just twist everything in a a denial of your love, your holiness. They try to turn the cross into something of a to be mocked. And God, just let the truth of all you did, all, what you went through in order to bring us into that family, let that be known. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.